Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. Today we have two interviews for you. First up is Chris Faddis. He's written the book It Is Well, Life in the Storm, and this documents his wife's abrupt diagnosis and struggle with cancer and how they put all their hope and trust in God. The second interview coming up is with Michael O'Brien, who has written the book Voyage to Alpha Centauri. This is Mr. O'Brien's first foray into a science fiction venue. Many have read his other books, Father Elijah and The Father's Tale. So right now we'll get started with those interviews. Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we have Chris Faddis with us. He's just written a book called It Is Well, Life in the Storm. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
I just want to give a little bit of a sense to our audience what this book is about. Chris and Angela Faddis were devout Christians with two young children who trusted in the Lord and his plan for their family. But the married couple's faith would receive an immense test on Easter Sunday, 2011, when Angela was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, and Angela died 17 months later, holding the hand of her husband, Chris. So, Chris, this must have been a very tough book to write.
Yeah, you know, in a way, it was tough, but in a way, it was also very healing. So, you know, there was such a grace about how everything transpired, and which you read about in the book, but it certainly allowed me to really reflect on that and reflect on the blessing of that. So, yes, there were painful parts, but it also was a very healing time for me.
And I love how the book is titled It As Well, because that was a song that was so important to you, really got you through this period. And actually, prior to your wife's diagnosis, it was something that was so important to your marriage.
Yes, it was. Trust was always a theme that was just really, even from the time we were dating, that we just talked, it was something that was important on my heart. It felt like it was a mission that God had called me to teach people to trust and also to, you know, really be a witness to that. And that song during that time, you know, there was a time when I was actually praying about writing a book on trust, and that song just kept striking a chord with me, and so I finally looked up the story. And the story of a man named Horatio who lost his 4 daughters at sea, and as he's traveling back across the Atlantic to meet his grieving wife, he passes over the spot where his daughters died, and he pens those words, "It is well with my soul. Whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." And that meant so much to Angela and I as a young married couple, and we reflected on it often, and we would say, wouldn't it be great if someone could write a book on trust in the middle of the storm? And that song really became that kind of theme for us. And when she was diagnosed, it became from day one, I was reminded of the meaning of that song, and I had to really face that for myself. Could I really say it as well?
Talk a little bit about how you and Angela met. You were almost a prototypical perfect Catholic couple with regards to living your faith life.
Well, we certainly had our failings and needed confession often, but you know, we both were graced with just great people in our lives at a young age to really give us that seed of faith and really help us to find that important and to make that important in our lives. So Angela grew up in the D.C. area. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. But she moved to Arizona, and we met, and for both of us, that faith, you know, had really been built up in our young, you know, high school and college years. And so, you know, we just both knew, I mean, she, from the very beginning, you know, she knew, she told me, you know, heaven is her most important goal in life, and she wanted marriage, she wanted children, she wanted all those things, but for her, none of that could get in the way of heaven. And so that was just our, you know, our goal, and that was what we planned for marriage, was that we were going to get each other to heaven. And like I said, we had our faults, we had our failings, we had our struggles, and all of the same struggles anyone else would deal with. But thankfully, by the grace of God, that faith was deeply planted within us that helped us to really make that the center and go back to that whenever we did struggle.
And that did sort of symbolize what your marriage was all about with regards to your decisions that you made with regards to your careers and whether or not you were going to pursue a lucrative career or whether or not you were going to stay in ministry. Talk a little bit about that and how and God's plan that worked out.
Sure. You know, we went through a time during our first year of marriage where we were really, you know, I had started a little business and, you know, we had a couple months that did okay, but it was difficult. And And we had really started to kind of fall into this thinking of, you know, a lot of the thinking that, most Americans fall into of, you know, somewhat of the American dream idea, you know, building wealth for yourself and all that, which isn't in and of itself a bad thing, but there became this focus that, we were being encouraged to, you know, this idea that if you think good things and you know, you can create your own destiny, so to speak. And we kind of started to fall into that, and hesitantly, I mean, we would have these questions, like, is this really scripturally sound? Is this really what God calls us to? But during that time, you know, I had really felt like, you know, maybe I would want to go into a better career, and so we talked about going back to school and going for me to become a doctor. And so that was, you know, what we focused on. And again, it's not such a bad thing. I mean, I have many friends who went back to school after they got married, but it became, the focus was building wealth, the focus was building our own destiny. And there was something in us that didn't feel right. And so through that discernment process, we even moved, and we were, you know, looking at the school we were going to start at, and we were, you know, figuring out the timing and all these things. We started to realize what we'd be giving up. And what we were giving up was, you know, ultimately, if I was going to do this fast-track program, you know, my wife was going to probably have to work because student loans wouldn't be enough. We would take on a ton of debt, and we had a young daughter at the time, and we had all along planned on having more children. And as we looked at that, we went, there's no way we can have children while I'm going to school. So that would mean waiting 5 or 6 years before having children, another child. It would mean me having to basically be gone from the family every day. And as we talked to people at the medical school, or chiropractic school, they said, yeah, you know, as long as you're willing to sacrifice, you know, we don't see my husband at all during the trimesters. And we sat there and we said, that just doesn't sit right with us. There's just something about it. And so as we prayed through and God really turned us back around to say, look, this isn't what I have for you, and there's a reason. And now looking back, I realize, you know, had I gone through with that plan, that 5-year plan we had, Angela would have been diagnosed with cancer right around the last year of my schooling, which would probably mean I wouldn't even have finished. And we would have missed out on that 5 years of our family. We would have missed out on that 5 years of our marriage, of our time together. We probably wouldn't have had our son, Augustine. So we saw that. I look back and I see how God, you know, he kind of pierced our heart in that way to say, you know, this isn't really a good idea for you guys. It doesn't mean it's not good for everybody. Some people can make that work. But for us, it clearly wasn't the plan. And so instead, you know, I took another kind of, you know, menial job that, you know, didn't pay very well, and we struggled. But we would often talk about during that time how we might struggle, but we had such intentional family time. We had, you know, yes, we couldn't go on vacation. We never made it to the Outer Banks of North Carolina when we lived there. We never made it to the beach. But we did go to the park a lot. We did, you know, have, you know, barbecue every Sunday during the summer. We did, you know, go to the pool. We did these family things that were important for us in being a family unit and building our marriage and our family around, you know, centered on God. And that, I look back, and I don't have any regrets about that. I lost my wife at a young age, but I don't have any regrets about how we lived those last years, whereas I would have had I gone with my plan.
Wow, that's
I would have had I gone. And so that's kind of in hindsight to say, wow, you know, God really does know where he's leading us because he knows what's coming.
Yeah, that's a profound thing to be grateful for, that you did have the ability to discern God's will and to follow that, because, you know, no regrets in terms of your family. Now, anyone who gets a diagnosis of cancer, it's never easy, but yours certainly was abrupt, and your wife was so young, and it happened on a holiday, on Easter. All of those things combined, I guess, then quickly with getting the news that this was stage 4 must have been overwhelming at the time. Talk about that, especially to our listeners who may be dealing with cancer in their own lives or possible other diagnoses of such terminal illness.
Sure. Yeah, you know, Angela was a very healthy person, and so we didn't really have any sign at all. You know, there was no symptoms or signs that really would have led us to this. I mean, she may have had abdominal discomfort from time to time and those things throughout her life, but never to the point that a doctor would have ordered a colonoscopy or anything of that extent. So Angela, you know, was just feeling sick, and it was, you know, Holy Week, and she was, you know, very severe abdominal cramping and was constipated and all these things. And so we were seeing the doctor that week, and, you know, they were giving us all these different things to do, and nothing was working. She would feel better one day and then get worse again the next. And finally, you know, she was very reluctant to go to the hospital. And finally, on, you know, in the middle of the night on Easter Sunday, she woke me up and said, okay, let's go. And so we went to the hospital, and we thought, you know, surely they'd just give her, you know, an enema. They'd do some different things, and they'd get everything cleared out, and she'd be okay and ready to eat, you know, eat an Easter dinner and go to Mass and all of that. And unfortunately, you know, she kind of persisted because they kept, you know, ruling it out as just, you just need a laxative. And she persisted a little more, and finally the doctor said, okay, let's go ahead and do an X-ray. And they did an X-ray, and they saw it was abnormal. But they came out, and they said, it's just abnormal. It's not a big deal. She's going to be fine. Why don't you take the kids home? We'll let you know when she's done. We're going to do one more scan, and we'll see. Took the kids home and sat down on the couch. By the time I got, you know, relaxed, they called and said, or Angela called and said, they want to see you. The doctors want to speak to you. So we got back in the car, went back to the hospital, and there you go. The doctors come in, and, you know, if you think of the movies and, you know, these kind of things that happen when somebody gets a cancer diagnosis or some tragedy happens, and, you know, the camera fades into a tunnel vision and the person hears this echo sound, that's everything you could imagine of that moment. I mean, it was as those scenes are as realistic as they get. There's nothing I could say. They said stage 4 colon cancer was possible. The tumor was blocking her colon completely. Her liver was completely covered in tumors. They suspected there were tumors in other areas. And all I knew is I knew 2 other people who got stage 4 cancer diagnosis, you know, and were gone within 2 months. So in my mind, my wife was going to die very shortly. It was extremely painful. It was, you know, I didn't know what to say. It was, you know, all of that. But the amazing thing is that faith that Angela was built, that had built up in her, you know, rather than her crying, rather than her, you know, screaming and shaking her fist at God, she just looked up to me and very simply said, Jesus still rose, so we will trust. It was Easter Sunday, and all she could think is, look, the promise of heaven is still there. So that was the beginning of our journey. It was painful, but it certainly was, it helped me to bring that back into focus, I guess.
Chris, too, a lot of people go through a range of emotions, and is it okay, given that situation, to doubt and to feel angry?
Certainly. You know, we tell the story a lot, and, you know, I tell the story a lot, and a lot of times people think, oh, man, I wouldn't be able to do that. I would be shaking my fist. I'd be lamenting. And the thing is, that was part of our journey, too, you know? Angela certainly had her, why did God let this happen? I had those moments. We had our tantrums with God, you know? And if you look all throughout Scripture, the psalmist would lament to God. And the saints, if you look through the stories of the saints lamented to God. But it's where we turn that lament. It's where we go with that. Do we take that lament and then turn our back on God and say, you know, forget you, you let this happen? I mean, that would have been, there was definitely that temptation. So we definitely had those moments. But I think what I learned, especially from Angela, was she would have those moments, but then she would turn back and say, but I'm going to trust God. All I can say is, Jesus, I trust in you. And that's what faith is. It doesn't mean we don't acknowledge the pain and the suffering. It doesn't mean we don't cry out. You know, Jesus tells the disciples, you know, the disciples cry out in the storm, Master, Master, save us, we are perishing. But, and Jesus says, why did you doubt? He's not condemning them. He's calling them to something deeper. He does want us to eventually trust to a point where we don't scream and wail, that we just simply trust. But Jesus knows that that's a process. And that's what I've really learned through this, that he gets it. He gets that lament, and he wants us to cry out to him. The problem is when we cry out, and then we despair, and we turn from God and say there's no hope left.
When you had a special intuition, I guess, maybe about that song, It Is Well, in your wildest dreams, could you ever have imagined God would ask you to live it out to the extent that he did?
Yeah, you know, I would say that I definitely didn't think that. When I was praying and discerning and writing this book on trust years ago, you know, I had actually sat down and wrote, you know, 5 chapters of it. And it wasn't a testimony. It wasn't a memoir. It was a lesson. It was me kind of walking through what God teaches us about trust. But it just didn't feel right. Like, that wasn't what God was calling me to. I had no clue what that meant. So no, did I ever think that he would, you know, that intuition that maybe someone should write this book while they're in the middle of the storm, maybe somebody should do what Horatio Spafford did with this song and actually write a book helping us understand what it means? Yeah, I thought that, but I didn't know it would be us. And I certainly didn't know it would be this kind of a storm. You know, at that time, I thought I had been through quite a bit. I'd been through job loss. I'd been through, you know, being out of money and not being sure where we were going to live next month. I'd been through all of that. So I thought I'd been through the worst. So I really didn't think that that's what God was calling me to. But now when I look back, it makes sense. You know, I remember a time, I would say, I think it was around 2002. I remember a time on a retreat where I felt God say to me, you're going to endure great suffering. And I went through a little bit of despair in that. And I honestly kind of ignored that from that. I kind of walked away from that. And it was recently that I remembered that. Mm. And so I see that now, that, you know, that God maybe was preparing our family for this great, this task, you know, to be able to share it. And I'm grateful for that, because I know for Angela too, you know, for her, that song and that sentiment and those things, I mean, we had been on this process, we've been through this process of really, of deciding together throughout our marriage that we needed to give more over to God and to fully rely on Him, that the understanding that God alone suffices. And so, you know, I didn't ever expect it, but I look back and I can see how God prepared our hearts. And I think it, you know, there's just something so important that I hope people will learn from this, is that when we turn our plans, our desires, all those things over to God, you know, God gives us desires of our heart. I wanted to be a writer my whole life. And I've never actually been able to sit down and finish a project. And yet here over the last year, I was actually able to do that, you know. When we give God those desires, when we give everything back to Him, He will order it properly. And it might take time. I mean, I would have never thought it would take this long to get to where we are, that we'd have to go through what we went through. But now I can see how He prepared that for us. And that's quite a gift.
We're speaking with Chris Faddis. He's written the book, It Is Well. It documents his struggle and his wife's struggle with cancer. And Chris, what's been the reaction when you tell the story and from people you talk to?
Sure. I've actually been out speaking for several months, so I've been able to share the story verbally. The book has just been out since October 1st, so there's still, people are still getting it. It's been shipped over the last couple of weeks, so people are still getting it. So I'm starting to get responses in. And the reaction generally is anything from somebody who's actually been through something like this or is going through something like this. And for most of them, I think, you know, the response has been that it's really helped them to have some hope, whether or not they've lost somebody or they're going through that. For several, it's been, you know, that maybe they're in despair of their own. And so there have been a lot of people who have been convicted by it in that way. But I think it, you know, somebody said to me yesterday, I read this book and I felt like I was being prepared for if this happens to me someday. If this happens, when this happens in my family and I have to let my wife go and I have to go through this. So there's all of the gamut of different, you know, people, things. My hope really is that people will really, three things. One is that this book will console hearts, that it will help people who are suffering, who are in the middle of the storm, and it will console them and help them to see what God's plan may be for them, and to see that God is still there and with them, and to see that there can be joy in the midst of it. And then also that people would understand, as Angela said at the end of her life, she said right before the doctor had told her she was going to die within a few days, and Angela said, I'm at peace, and I want the world to know that no matter what, they must trust in Jesus. And so that's a big part of this goal, that they would see through Angela's witness that is shared in this book, that we must trust in Jesus no matter what. At every stage of our journey, whether we're in great triumph or in great trial, whether we have it all or we've lost it all, whether we're giving up even the things that are so good, like family and loved ones and marriage and turning that over to God, that we trust in Jesus. And so, and then the third is that there would just be just a sense of solace there, that would, you know, that people would understand to move, you know, them through these kind of trials. And I think that's important, that we think about that ahead. You know, this isn't a book just for if you're in the trial, because we really do have to prepare our hearts and pray while things are good and offer and really ask those questions of ourselves. Would I be prepared to trust? And if I'm not prepared to trust at that level that Angela did, I need to go to God and say, God, help me to have that kind of trust. Help me to have the trust that the saints had. Help me to trust like St. Therese, like St. Faustina, and like St. Gianna. Help me to really be able to turn myself over to you and know that my only solace in this life is heaven, is the promise of heaven. And when we can do that, then these trials, yes, they're painful, but we can get through them because we can find that joy.
Was reading St. Therese, her last conversations, was that at all a solace or a help?
Certainly. Angela and I both have read through those. I've never read the whole thing or, all of her writings, but that was one that we both had, flipped through often. And some people reminded me of some of those quotes kind of towards the end and after Angela died. And there was a sense, we never had this conversation, but for me, that what Angela, would express to me when we would talk about those writings years ago, and what Angela lived in the end, that she really had allowed it, I guess, to kind of be grafted into her being, because she didn't talk about it at the end. But if I look at how she lived in the end, she certainly lived out those writings. She certainly lived out, those things. And, even just simple things like, that really the kind of, if you look at the overall theme of St. Therese, it's, total dependence on God's divine providence. And that truly is where Angela ended her life, was to fully have surrendered it all and to say, I just rely on you, I trust in you, Lord, and that's it. Everything else is for naught. That was lived out.
Yeah, and I also think, too, on St. Therese's writings, that she often described life as just a brief moment between two eternities. She would often refer to life as sort of a death, that we actually become alive when we enter into heaven. And she was always seeking to use every minute she had here on earth to offer in reparation so that she could bring many souls to Jesus. Now, I know that your wife also, Angela, also spoke about, I'm not ready to go yet, I'm not holy enough. And I just thought that was an amazing thing, that she was working so hard to perfect herself and to suffer for others. It must be something that was very heroic.
It certainly was, especially in those last 2 months. She was offering her suffering throughout, but really in those last 2 months, as she came face-to-face with the reality that she really was going to die. And barring, we certainly always hoped for a miracle, but you also face reality, and reality is that her body was dying. Her body was in that process. And so she really had to face those things. And it was so interesting because she would talk about, wanting to be there for the kids, and she would talk about all the things she was letting go of. But then when she would say that phrase, I'm not ready to go, I would say, because of the kids, and she'd say, no, I'm not holy enough. And I would just simply say, Angela, just trust God. He will make you holy. And one of the things she said at the very beginning of her diagnosis is she said, I realize that God plans to purify me with this cancer. He's going to use this trial to purify me. And I hope I'll be able to live. I hope I'll live through this cancer, but I do know that he will purify me. And so in those last couple months, I think Angela really started to really surrender to that and understand, as people were praying for her, and there were thousands of people around the country and even around the world that were praying for her, as Angela began to offer her suffering for them, and Angela began to offer her suffering for children that were with cancer and all these different things that she just started doing, and she wasn't really even saying it. But I would ask her about it, and she would tell me. And what I saw was, as she fully surrendered that and said, I'm at peace, and basically said, God can take me when he's ready, God then allowed her to be there. She actually stayed around for another 4 weeks. And during that time, she offered all of that suffering she went through. She endured great pain in the end, and yet she offered that, for souls. And what we saw was an incredible beauty, an incredible mystery unfolded before us. And in that, people would come into the room, priests would come to visit her, and they would say, I feel like I'm being ministered to here, I'm walking into a holy place when I walk into this room. And it was an incredible experience to watch as her soul truly was purified right before our eyes.
And you also heard from people on the internet who went back to church. There were just amazing stories, just because people had sort of broadcast the fact that they were praying for her, and you undoubtedly heard a lot of stories about conversions, correct?
Yeah, I mean, right when she began, one of the things she said that day when the doctor came to visit and she said, I'm at peace, she also told the doctor, she said, I have a lot of people to pray for when I get to heaven. And I realized in that what she meant then was that all these people who had been praying for her, all these people who had been lifting us up and our family up, that she was already beginning to pray for them. And so about a week or two later, I started to get messages, and I got the first one that said, I just want you to know that I went back to church for the first time in many years because I've been praying for Angela, and I just was moved to go back. And I'm so happy to be home. And then I got a text message from a close friend who said, I just want you to know my sister hasn't been to church in 10 years. She went to Mass with my family today. Another one from another friend. And then the emails began to come in even more from all over the country. And it was incredible. So many conversions of heart. So many conversions in marriage, and so many people who were consoled in their own suffering through praying for Angela, and some you know, quote unquote miracles that, you know, people who were infertile who had been praying for Angela and you know, ended up being able to conceive during those last days of her life. There was incredible witness to the idea of redemptive suffering, which, you know, we knew of, but we didn't really fully get it. And I began to see what power there was there, that our redemptive suffering works even while we're on earth. You know, that the graces can be poured out while we're here on earth and not just once we're in heaven. It was an incredible consolation for my family. You know, I would share those stories with Angela, and she seemed kind of like, on one hand, it seemed like she already knew, and on the other hand, it seemed as if she didn't, not that she didn't care, but that she didn't need that consolation. She knew where she was going, and she was kind of removed from that. But it certainly was a consolation for us to see how God was working in her suffering.
Chris, as we close, I just want to talk about the importance of community. Certainly, no one gets through this alone, and how important it was to have people around you. What advice would you give people who are watching loved ones suffer? What can they do as a community? What advice do you give them?
You know, we often want to suffer in a closet. You know, we often want to hide our suffering and, you know, and keep it from other people. You know, I think we have to allow one another to suffer together. We have to allow each other the opportunity to you know, do this together and share. And so, you know, no one has to do it as publicly as we did. I mean, we had a Facebook page that was set up for us and all these things. So our story was very public. And you don't have to be very public. But I think we need to just be honest and open with those around us and that community around us. And then for those of us who aren't suffering, who are watching it, to just be present, to be in prayer. There are times when you can help, and there's times when there's nothing you can do. But the whole time you can be in prayer, and you can be just offering that consolation. You know, we often want to remove a person's suffering or our own suffering, and I think that's our biggest temptation, is to get out of the suffering as quickly as possible. But I think we have to ask ourselves, what mercy might God want to impart during this long suffering? And so we need to, yes, you know, we alleviate pain, and we do those things we can do, and we certainly feed, and we certainly take care of people and do all those things, but we also have to allow some of that suffering to happen so that the person can receive the mercy that God has, because he really does want to impart something to us through our suffering. So I think it's important that we console and we comfort and we feed and we do those things, but we also allow the suffering to happen. And sometimes that might be painful, but just by sitting there and holding their hand, we can, you know, we've got to be able to do that. So, and just allow that to happen. There's a beauty that happens, and I think for me as a caretaker, there was such a great lesson in not doing anything. It was very hard to transfer from, you know, from doing everything I could to help Angela get better to now having to sit back and allow her to suffer and allow her to go. But for me, it allowed me then to trust in God, to say, okay, God, you have a plan here. And I don't know what's going on between you and her right now. I can't see that relationship, but I know something's happening. And by allowing that, it was a beautiful process that brought me great healing and those around us. And so that community is very important, and it's important to just be present.
Chris, would you consider writing a book for preteens or adolescents with regards to losing a parent?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought a lot. You know, I have two children, Augustine and Gianna, and they've done very well through this grief. But there's been a great grace there. But they are, you know, there's new things. You know, there's layers when you go through grief, and some of those layers are coming off again, and we're facing some things again. And so I've thought about this. I was reflecting on this morning in my drive. I think at some point I probably will. I don't know what it is. I actually just kind of gave that to God. I think this book, you know, the book about Angela really can be read by a teen. There actually are some preteens who are reading it that, you know, friends of mine whose children are reading it. you know, it's not something that is an easy topic. It's painful for kids to think about their parents dying, but it's certainly at that level where they could understand it, I think. I certainly think it's something for teenagers that they certainly could get. But I'm praying about it, and I think it's important that those kind of books be out there. So if God calls me to, I'm certainly willing. I think the most important thing for people, if they are facing that with their children, is that you don't hesitate to talk about what is happening for them in heaven. It is so important, so important that we talk to our children about heaven and about what, you know, the reality of heaven and what is happening there, what God is doing there, and we cannot hesitate to share that enough. And to share the truth about heaven, not this kind of ethereal, these kind of secular views of heaven and how we become angels. We don't become angels. We go to heaven and we become saints. And that is something that our children can actually connect to and can understand. And we can talk about people like St. Therese, as you mentioned, who talk about the good work they can do in heaven. My daughter's named Gianna. We talk about St. Gianna, who said she could be a better mother in heaven than on earth. We need to reflect, we need to help them understand that, because they can connect to that and they can grasp that, and they can understand that their parent or their loved one that they lost isn't just some being floating in the sky, that they're a saint sitting at the throne of God, and they are doing God's work, and they are doing good works in heaven, and they are still alive and well. And that's important for them to understand. So I do hope that at some point I'll be, called to do that, or someone will. That's my advice for those who might be facing that.
That sounds great. Wonderful explanation of how important that is to put that forward. Well, we've been speaking with Chris Faddis, and his book is called All Is Well. Chris, where can people find you if they need to communicate with you, if they maybe are going through something and they just want to reach out to talk to somebody who's been there?
It Is Well, just so you know, the book, It Is Well, Life in the Storm. And they can go to itiswellbook.com, itiswellbook.com. And that has the book available, as well as all the information about me coming out to speak at parishes. And then it's also available on Amazon.
Thank you so much, Chris, for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Barbara.
You are listening to Walking in Faith, right here at Holy Spirit Radio, WISP in Doylestown, and WCOJ in Coatesville. Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we're speaking with Michael O'Brien. He is a novelist, and his latest novel is called Voyage to Alpha Centauri. Many of you know him. He's a prolific writer. Welcome, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Barbara. It's good to be with you.
Now tell us a little bit about this new novel. It's the first time you've written in the science fiction genre.
Yes, it is. It's after 9 other novels, it's quite a radical departure, but I've always been fascinated by astronomy and the universe. And I have always kind of longed to go out there, even though that's impossible. So I thought, well, a story about what would happen if we go out there is certainly within our abilities. We can dream, we can imagine.
That's right. And this tells the story of Neil de Hoyos, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who has played a major role in designing this spaceship that he's on. And I love the fact that you talk about the idea of looking up, looking beyond where we are now and looking up and looking for meaning in life. Is that being too transcendent with what you're thinking about in terms of some of the themes here?
No, that's crucial to the story, ultimately. That's the spiritual meaning of the world. The novel asks us some big questions. What, for instance, within us is always moving us to look beyond, to look farther and deeper? In the modern age, where there's been such a loss of faith and a loss of genuine spirituality, we've replaced science with religion. Technology especially offers us incredible powers, I would say, near angelic powers compared to previous generations. So that has its gifts, but it also has extreme dangers for us in terms of our pride, our blindness. What are we seeking out there in infinity? Is it just more knowledge? That's what the story asks. Or is there something inside of us that's yearning for the transcendent, for really the truth? truly metaphysical, spiritual.
I saw an interview of yours where you actually quoted G.K. Chesterton on that, and you talk about, you know, when you don't have religion in your life, there's a void, there's a hole there.
Yes.
And many people mistake that as saying that when men cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing. They begin to believe in anything, and they fill that void. And I love how the fact that you talk about, you know, the scientific rationalism is sort of being a mini religion for them. And it's they've replaced their own knowledge and thirst for God with their own search for meaning. So I think that this novel gets at that.
Yes, it's also asking what happens within us when we think we have found the answers, and especially when we think we have a superior vision to other human beings because of our knowledge. But knowledge can't save, and really the story demonstrates that, acts out that in the flesh. I don't want to give away too much of the plot.
Right.
You know, this spaceship from planet Earth set about 100 years in the future is going to our nearest, the star nearest our solar system, Alpha Centauri, to a very Earth-like planet, which has been discovered. And what the voyageurs discover on that planet will shock them, will surprise them, and it will raise further questions about the nature of our civilization.
When we talk about this novel, you mentioned that it's set 100 years in advance and sort of in a prophetic way where you think the country might be headed. You talk about America being ruled by a totalitarianism with a friendly face. Technology is rewarding and omnipresent. Surveillance is sophisticated and subtle. Sexual morality is relativized. Depopulation laws are draconian. Sterility is rewarded. Fertility is punished. And there's kind of a green is good and organized religion is bad mentality that sort of pervades America 100 years hence. This is, again, a novel we're speaking about. And although there is a peaceful sort of democracy in America, there's very limited personal freedom. You know, this was in some ways prophetic, but were you surprised at how quickly some of the themes in this novel have evidenced themselves already in our lives?
Yes, I've been writing about the dangers, the potential in democratic societies for totalitarianism for about 20 years. And when I wrote Voyage to Alpha Centauri, I had about 3-4 years ago, I had no idea how quickly events would accelerate. It is very surprising. But I think in the Snowden affair, and also the more messy or equally messy, ugly affair of WikiLeaks, what we're seeing is that human beings, for whatever their motivation may be, human beings are taking a stand. Governments do not have the right to violate basic human dignity and integrity. Governments, no matter what their motivation is, do not have the right to invade the family or to destroy human privacy. Once governments start doing that, we have not only a loss of the civil freedoms guaranteed in your constitution as Americans, I'm a Canadian, we've been living with this longer than you have, you know, the violation of civil rights, but it's been done very nicely here with great politeness, but the omnipresent state has within itself not only an arrogance or a pride, but a power to deform the coming generations, to corrupt our basic human community. The world is a community of communities, human communities. We have many problems, but the state itself cannot solve it by enforcing a kind of imposed serenity on everything. There are always victims whenever governments try to do that, always. And so we need to look at the nature of our society and the nature of the governments we elect and see that the preservation of human life, all human life from conception, natural death is our first priority. If we lose that, we're going to lose everything.
Can you you speak to the fact that why would the state or why does government have such an interest in controlling human reproduction? What is it that you see in terms of history and in terms of religion and technology? Why is that such a key issue?
Well, I think purely on a rationalist level, governments know that when they control the generation of human life, or at least they make it possible for the destruction of human life in a, quote, legal way, they're really taking on powers. I'm talking about the theorists here, not the middle-level people who, you know, act out these laws, these new laws, anti-life, anti-family laws. They have placed themselves above mankind. We will decide what is good for you, they say to themselves and to us. We will protect you. We will give you peace and security. But that means there is a cost. They won't say this, but there is a cost always. The destruction of a portion of humanity in the name of humanity is always what happens, always. And that is totalitarianism, regardless of the form of government you have. Why did they do it? I think at root there is not just an intellectual or ideological component. I think there's a spiritual dimension. You mentioned earlier the void. Such people who want to control mankind to that degree, they have a void within themselves that they've filled with political theory or sociological theory about how to fix the human condition. And they're going to apply force and all the powers of the modern state to test their theory, to bring it about. And that means there's going to be resistance. The Snowden affair and others like it are showing us that the human spirit cannot be crushed, and human nature yearns for freedom. So that means in the future, already, but in the future, there will be more and more conflict between the truly human society of free men and women and the neo-totalitarian state. We can expect more of that.
I also find in the novel the theme of memory and identity, and this is something John Paul II talked about a lot, and Pope Benedict mm-hmm. XVI as well. Can you talk a little bit about that and the ability for human beings to recollect themselves?
Yes. Well, to answer your question, I'd like to quote from Pope Benedict, and Pope Francis has said similar things too, but Benedict says it in a very lucid, powerful way in an address to European parliamentarians a couple of years ago. He said, urging them to remember, to not forget the Christian foundation of Europe and the Christian principles which made it a civilization. He said this very simple sentence. He said, "We are losing the basic memory of mankind." In other words, end quote. In other words, we are forgetting who we are. We are forgetting our history, and once you forget your history, once you lose connection with who you are, you become extremely dependent on whatever social forces are around you, whatever media, propaganda, whatever false definitions of what it is to be a human being. You become very vulnerable to all that. If you do not know who you are in terms of your place in the stream of time, your people, your history. More profoundly, if you do not know your spiritual identity as a son or daughter of God, as a child of the Father, once states replace the authority of God and the moral authority of God, the moral absolutes, we become extremely vulnerable. So we have to go back to our spiritual roots before we can go forward. The new evangelization means we need to know who we are before we go out into the world to bring the good news.
one of the best lines I loved in the novel was when one of the characters looked at a child and said, "If only we understood how beautiful, we would want nothing else."
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at the root of our present blindness is the speed at which we live, the complexity of our lives. We are rushing towards making the good life, coping with all kinds of difficulties, galloping towards some really undefined end, which is vaguely defined to us as, or we define to ourselves as some kind of comfort or some kind of security. And we love our children. We want to give them a good future. But there's a kind of, to quote Thoreau, there's a kind of quiet desperation to it all. And unless you have tons and tons and tons of money to make it all work, we're living at a frantic pace, and this is not a human pace. This is a killing pace. And so the temptation increases to get rid of problems, to reduce the number of children in our lives, to make compromise with sin, agree with politicians and theorists who slice moral theology so thinly that you can slip a battleship through it. Great evil result from such nuances. And we don't even know it's being done to us. We need to wake up to the fact that the great treasure of life is love and truth. We need to accept that life has struggle. It is incredibly beautiful, but it is also, for all of us, has struggle. And if we create a life around us that eliminates all struggle and pain, we're going to have, on some level, we're going to have an unhuman life or an undeveloped life. Suffering tests us. Suffering forces us to grow. It asks of us big questions. But in the midst of all the struggles, if we look at the face of a child and we see this miracle of a new human being given to us by our Father Creator, this mystery, this future that is not yet visible, it challenges us to love in ways that we have not yet loved, to expand the heart and the understanding. It also, anyone who's a parent knows, it also means you have to learn to pray more deeply and more consistently, especially when they're teenagers, and so forth. But life overcomes death to the degree that we love and that we're willing to sacrifice for love. And, I hope that's what comes through my novel as well. It is love, I mean, authentic love, not cheap love. Authentic love is the power that will save the world.
Today we're speaking with Michael O'Brien, and the new novel that he's put out is called A Voyage to Alpha Centauri. And I was wondering if you would possibly want to read a selection so our listeners can get a sense of your writing and the cadence of it.
Well, Barbara, this is a passage towards the end of the book where our central character, Neil, an old man, a scientist, who has befriended a young couple on the ship, two scientists, they have secretly, clandestinely conceived and had a child. They're secretly married by an underground priest aboard the ship, and they have had a child, an illegal child. Now, the ship is ruled, at least in its social dimension, by the Department of Social Infrastructure, called DSI. And they've been watching everything, and they've been preventing Neil, the central character, from going up to visit the newborn baby. They can't touch the baby because it's up on the flight deck of this immense ship. It's the size of a city. But they can prevent Neil from going up where DSI has less power, less authority, because that's That's the deck on the ship that's ruled by the flight crew, the captain's flight crew. On lower decks, it's ruled by DSI. Anyway, day 404 on the planet that they've discovered, Neil makes an entry in his journal, and he says this: a DSI agent was standing in the hallway when I left my room this morning. He didn't say a word, but he followed me to the cafeteria, and after I had my breakfast, he followed me back. Then I led him on a merry chase, zigging and zagging in a random pattern throughout the maze of Deck B, all the while getting ever closer to Street 22. The time I arrived... By the time I arrived there, I had turned so many corners that his guard was lowered and he was lagging half a block behind. I turned onto 22 and hobble-hoofed at my top speed to the KC elevator, typed in the code as fast as I could and stepped inside. I didn't look back. The doors closed and I went up. I don't know if he spotted me. Paul ushered me into the bedroom of their apartment. Pia was lying on the bed, eyes closed, looking serene, if a little drawn. The baby rested under her right arm, swaddled and flawless, her large black eyes regarding me with total consciousness. I knelt down beside the bed and kissed the baby's forehead. She began to cry, waking up Pia. Pia and Paul let me hold her. I had never experienced this in my life. Not even long ago in our village. The grandmothers had always monopolized that sort of thing, and my paternal instinct was entirely latent then. Now it blossomed. Flooded, actually. I was in love. I was totally in love. "Do you like her, Neil?" Pia asked. I nodded up and down in the affirmative. When I was able to speak, I whispered, "Catherine Teresa." For the longest time, I gazed enraptured at her little face as she gazed back at me. Finally, Paul, the Night Prince, tapped my shoulder and said that the baby needed to nurse now. It was time for me to go. I gave the princess back to her mother and babbled inept congratulations to her parents. We concluded with handshakes, hugs, and final kisses. On my way back downstairs, I kept thinking, "Oh, mankind, why are you so blind when you can have this?"
Again, that was Michael O'Brien reading a selection from his book, the novel Voyage to Alpha Centauri. How beautiful. What a privilege and what a gift to have that. Thank you so much for reading that. Just a few final questions before we go. I know that you're an iconographer, and I've seen people review this book and talk about how you use symbols as motifs. How do you relate to that in terms of a writer versus a painter, and the idea of using symbols and as motifs as themes in the novel? How do those arts and poetry kind of cross currents to do that as an artist?
Well, I would have to say I'm not a trained writer. Never been to university, and I've never taken writer's workshops. I write intuitively. I write praying very much for all of my works. So, because also I have been a painter, primarily a painter for 40 years, raised my family by being a Catholic artist, these two languages of the visual arts and writing are both very strong streams within me, and so I think they just flow out together at certain times. My writing has enabled my painting to be more concise, for me to be more conscious of the form of a work. The painting has informed my writing, has helped me be a better writer by being sensitive to creating prose pictures, so that my reader is seeing what I'm seeing. So I think both languages of art, of these two very different arts, give life to each other. But how that happens, I'm not sure. It just kind of flows.
And does it also make you more profoundly contemplate the incarnation and a God that would give us the conception of an incarnation of himself?
Yes. Yes, the hidden face of God has been made visible in Jesus. And now we can receive him through the sacraments and prayer and scripture. But the world, all of creation, it's an incarnational universe. It's a sacramental universe. It's not a sola scriptura universe. And maybe that's too part of the way I write and the way I paint, is that God pours out his graces on all of us, trying to help us to see that all creation is holy, and even what is damaged can be restored to the Father through grace, through repentance. That's also one of the major themes of this new novel, A Voyage to Alpha Centauri, that if we insist on our pride and our powers and our knowledge, we're living in a tiny, stunted universe, no matter how big it looks to us. If we open the heart to grace, we move into a very, very big universe, not just a physical universe.
One of the first books that I read of yours was A Landscape with Dragons, and as a parent, I really appreciated it. Talk a little bit about how the culture has sort of desensitized our children with regards to the traditional images of good and evil.
Yes, well, in a nutshell, what we've been seeing in Western culture, especially literary and now media, film material, television directed at children and young adults, is a redefinition of the meaning of good and evil. If you want to spend a day or a week watching everything that is mainstream for young people, you're going to be astounded by the overwhelming amount of redefinitions of good and evil. That there is still a struggle between good and evil is a hopeful sign, but it's the redefinitions which are the problem. Often evil, and this is almost consistent throughout almost all of youth culture, children's literature especially, is that evil means are used to overcome evil. So that's moral relativism. You will almost always find that in literature and the films, the spin-off films. Also disturbing is a kind of new spirituality that comes in. There's a lot of supernatural elements in much of children's and young adults' films, supernatural powers. Like, I'm not against fantasy. I love fantasy, and we've read a good deal of it, healthy fantasy to our children. But I think the question parents have to ask themselves, what is the nature of good and evil as it is presented in this book or this film? Second question would be, how do the good characters, the characters your children identify with, how do they overcome the evil? What are the means? Also, a third and equally important question would be, what is the presentation in the novel or film of the supernatural? What's being communicated to your children for that, through that? There's a whole lot of other questions, but that's why I had to write
a
book.
Well, I was going to tell our listeners, if you want to find out more about that theme and that subject, the book is called A Landscape with Dragons. Can people find out more about you by visiting your website? Would you like to give out that address?
Sure. My website address, where people can look at my art and my writings, fiction and nonfiction, is www.studiobrian.com. That's S as in Sam, TUDIOBRIEN.com.
And also, I want to just mention again where the book is available. It's published by Ignatius Press, so obviously you can find it there, and I think they have some pretty good deals going on. You can also get it as an ebook on any of the major retail booksellers online. And you can also probably find it in your local Catholic bookstore. And again, we have been speaking with the novelist Michael O'Brien. The book, again, is called The Voyage to Alpha Centauri. It's his first foray into science fiction and something not to be missed. We thank you so much for your time this morning.
Well, thank you, Barbara. God bless you.
God bless. Thank you.